Welcome. I'm Sarah White, a retired director of pharmacy. I hope this conversation stimulates you to think about how to continue to evolve our pharmacy services on behalf of our patients. Remember, every pharmacist needs to be a little L leader on their shift or in their practice. While each person's career evolves in a different way, what you'll find as a baseline is them making and seizing opportunities. By way of introduction, Dennis Tribble received his PharmD degree from the University of Pacific and completed a residency at the Moses H. Cone Memorial Hospital. He has held leadership positions throughout his career, beginning with assistant director and then director before moving into the computer arena with Health Data Sciences, BAXA, 4Health, and is currently Director, Medical Affairs, Pharmacy Drug Delivery, Specialty Pharmaceuticals, and Medical Products for Baxter Healthcare. His organizational leadership positions have included being a Presidential Officer for the Illinois Council of Health System Pharmacists, Chairman of the Executive Committee for the ASHP Section on Pharmacy Informatics and Technology, membership on the AJHP Editorial Board, and membership on the Research and Education Steering Committee for the Environmental Survey presented at last mid-year clinical meeting. Welcome, Dennis.
Thank you, Sarah. It's a little important, I think, before we begin our conversation, that because I'm a member of the pharmaceutical community, I need to make a statement so that my role here is very clear. The comments I will make during our discussion are my own opinions, and they don't reflect the opinions of either ASHP or my employer. And so just want to be very clear that I'm not speaking on behalf of my employer in this case.
Okay, I appreciate that. You've been very active in the development and evolution of pharmacy informatics. Please define what it is and share its evolution with us.
It's probably not a well-defined term. In general, we think of informatics as the science of the management of information and directing it appropriately to the practice. One of the most important things we did early on in the section on informatics was to recognize that informatics, by and large, is a process of tool making. We don't exist for our own right, you know, unlike a cardiology practice or infectious disease practice or something like that. We exist to make tools to facilitate the practice of pharmacy. And so informatics then becomes, how do I bring the information that a clinician needs to the practice of managing patient therapy in a way that makes them more effective? What are the tools I bring that change the way information is delivered? In some instances, that also means, are there electromechanical devices and other things that actually automate physical processes? But by and large, informatics is about data becoming information.
How did you become interested in computers, since you were in pharmacy leadership as an assistant director and then a director for over a decade?
It was a love affair at first sight, actually. My wife and I went to a personal computer meeting in 1981, and of course the state of computing at that point was, shall we say, primitive, but I kind of fell in love with the idea, and several things happened at this roughly the same time. The hospital where I was a director developed some spare capacity on a computer system they already had and said, gee, would you like to computerize your pharmacy? And I was young and naive and said, sure. At the same time, the church I was going to brought in one of the early Radio Shack computers and rapidly discovered that getting it to do what they wanted it to do was more difficult than they thought. And they said, well, gee, Dennis plays with this at work. Why don't we ask him to do it? In that process, I actually learned my first programming language and wound up writing a church system. It wasn't good, but it was better than what they had. And so from then on, it just the whole notion of how would the practice change if we didn't have to be hunter-gatherers of information in order to get our practice done just really fascinated me, and that took me from there.
Okay. How do you currently maintain and enhance your knowledge and skills?
Reading mostly, some experience. It's one of the things I like about being in industry is that part of what I do for a living is actually create new systems. So I'm constantly looking at new technologies. I'm constantly looking at what other people have done, trying to stay on top of what the new technologies on the underbelly of the process are. Those things are a little bit less obvious to the consumer community. But it's a matter of continuing to follow the passion. I did learn that I didn't want to be a programmer for a living, but I still enjoy doing it on occasion, and I still have code running in devices. But there's lots of ways to do that. And in many cases, it's simply asking someone's question to which I, or answering someone's question to which I don't currently know the answer.
Could you give us some examples of things that you read?
Principally, I'm reading online digests of news from various marketplaces. There are some really, really good, I read Modern Healthcare, which ordinarily has quite a bit of information on the current informatics state within healthcare. Get a fair amount of information from the programmers and designers that I work with on new technologies they think I ought to be considering for inclusion in various products. And then, of course, I read ASHP, a number of things. The ASHP news digest that I get every day turns out to be a fascinating source of opportunity and insight, and as well as ASHP Connect.
I can honestly say that you're the first pharmacist I've interviewed that has listed patents on their CV. Talk a little bit about why one would and how to get a patent.
Patents are a form of what are called intellectual property that include things like trademarks and copyrights and those kinds of things. And a patent is basically a representation that you have created something novel. And the term novel has very specific meaning in terms of a patent. So in order to get a patent, you have to identify an invention that you can defend to the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office, represent something no one has done before. And so it's an expensive process to go through. I probably would not have had patents had I not been in an industry where patenting things you do is an important protective element in terms of managing your portfolio of intellectual property. A good friend of mine, Brian Baldwin, would often say, you always pay for a patent twice, once when you get it and once when you defend it. There's always a very careful decision-making process that has to go around the value of the intellectual property versus the cost, time, and effort of getting the patent.
Could you give us a couple of examples of the patents you'd listed on your CV?
Wow.
Just to give us a flavor for...
Some of them are pretty esoteric. In the early days of one of our robotic devices, we discovered that if we were going to wait for the kinds of cooperation that are necessary for a standard HL7 interface, that we probably couldn't get to market in time. And so we took a technology, which is actually quite old, called label scraping, literally the ability to emulate a printer or pretend to be a printer and then read the data that would normally be printed by the printer. And we added to that the concept that we would selectively take things from that printer stream and would return the remainder to the printer to be printed out and used in the way it had always been. It turned out that selective use was something that was novel, and so that was patented. And that patent actually has stood us in good stead.
Okay. You've spent the last 27 years of your professional life in what we would call the industry. Why did you move from practice to the industry?
Good question. Something I often ask myself, actually. At the end of the day, you get to a point, I think, in any career where you look around yourself and say, okay, am I going to do the same thing again? Or am I going to move on and do something a little bit different? I had spent 2 years with my hospital, helping them acquire and then implement a healthcare information system. And I had developed a rather significant list of things I wished those systems did, because I knew if they would do those things, they would really move the needle on informatics, not just for pharmacy, but for healthcare. And I wound up being recruited by a startup company in California who, in 1986, was doing things we now associate with meaningful use. So they were well ahead of their time. And they recruited me to come and help them first to develop marketing. And so I started out in the marketing role. And then eventually I migrated over into product development, which is where I got to design what I would consider my first really functional pharmacy application. In the process, I learned a lot more about programming than I ever thought I would know. I did take a cut in pay to go do the job. It was worth every penny, because I wouldn't be where I am now. I couldn't do what I'm doing now if I hadn't taken that risk and that opportunity. But at the end of the day, I got to the point where I realized that to make the changes in practice that I knew I wanted to make, I couldn't do it from within the context of a hospital. I had to go somewhere where there was the interest and the resource and the expertise to make those things occur. And that turned out to be industry.
So could you talk a little bit more about when you say you took a cut in pay and it was worth it? Drill down a little bit on that, because that's a decision point a lot of people come up to, and it's easy to say it was worth it, but what does that really, what did that mean to you, I guess, is what I'm asking.
You know, I think when we look at practitioners, actually people in general, there are folks that I like to think of kind of fall into two buckets. And one of those buckets is I get comfortable with a job that I do. It gives meaning to my life. I enjoy meeting the same challenge every day. I enjoy overcoming that. And those people are clinicians, right? Because it is the joy of treating individuals and managing their health that overcomes what might otherwise be the ennui of fighting the same battle every day. I cannot overcome that ennui. I need to be constantly challenged with something new, something different, ideas that seem wild but just might turn out to be really useful. And industry offered me that opportunity. It's not for everyone. It's riskier, mm-hmm. right? The rewards are greater. Mm-hmm. The thing I would tell someone who really wants to think about a career in industry is to recognize that the decision to go into industry does place constraints on things you might ordinarily think of as easy to do. There are now conflict of interest issues that you have to worry about if you wish to publish or to speak. Depending on the size of the company, there may be constraints within the company itself on what you're allowed to say, simply to protect the company's best interests. And you have to honor all that and still find a way to contribute in that process. ASHP, I think, has done a remarkable job of providing me as an individual and many of my colleagues with those venues.
So your first job, as you just talked about, was health data sciences. Then where did you go, and how did that happen?
Well, there's such a thing as a job that you love too much. I was working roughly 100 hours a week, not because my employer demanded it, but because the problem fascinated me that much. I actually had a home office that was outfitted the same as my real office. I would get up early in the morning and go to work. I'd come home, have dinner with my family, and then go into my office and work some more. About the time my daughters got to be teenage girls, I realized I didn't know who they were and they didn't know who I was. And so we made a conscious decision to take a job that I hoped I would find somewhat less fascinating. That didn't turn out to be too true, but in the process of doing that, I got to know and work with the folks at BAXA, and they made me an offer I couldn't refuse, and we relocated to Denver. And I was able to find a much stronger work-life balance in that environment. And frankly, medical devices in general and pharmacy devices in particular are a really, really fun place because they're an amalgam of my clinical background, my pharmacy training, and my informatics training that allows me to really, really make a difference in places that matter to me, which is in the institutional pharmacy.
So for our audience, describe a little bit about what BACSA produces for folks that might not be knowledgeable.
Well, of course, BACSA is no longer BACSA. They were bought by Baxter about 2 years ago. But our primary product lines were and are around the automation of the preparation of liquid doses. So TPN, we probably the largest group of TPN compounders out there. One of the products of which I'm very proud is an IV workflow management software product, which as of last count has over 30 million doses under its belt and has prevented over 1 million wrong drug product selections during IV compounding. That's a nail you can hang your hat on and be somewhat proud. And so we do those kinds of things. Our intimacy with the pharmacy profession was always a real strong point for the company, and they were more facilitative than many that I've been aware of in permitting me to maintain and develop good professional relationships, a strong relationship with the society, pretty much at my own pace. So when BACSA was purchased, my role at that time was chief pharmacy officer. I reported one level below the CEO on the line chart and directly to the CEO for all practical purposes. Which is another thing I'd want to tell people. In most organizations, there's the line organization and there's the flow of knowledge and power. Both are important to keeping the business running, but it's important to also understand how both of those organizations work, because that's how you succeed.
And you're speaking of the informal kind of structure, if
that's
you
correct.
Will, yes. As it's referred to. Drop back a bit and your ability to have a bit better balance on career and life, because that's always something people are struggling for. Obviously, you changed jobs, but then what else did you do to try to do that?
One of the things that turned out to be kind of a savior of all that was a YMCA program called Indian Princesses, which, for those who aren't familiar with it, it's like a Boy Scouts or a Girl Scouts, only it's with dads and daughters. And it allowed me to formalize time on my schedule where I was going to be with my children and where I could say to the people who would otherwise make demands of my time, I'm sorry, but I'm busy at that date and time. I'm not going to be available. And since I, like many, tend to be tyrannized by the urgent, having that become part of the urgent turned out to be really important for me.
So making that conscious decision, one that you realized you were out of balance and changing career, but then finding a way that you could get it into your schedule seems key.
Yes, absolutely. Serendipity doesn't work.
And
your family deserves every bit as much planning and concentration as you put into your job, because if you don't, they'll get lost.
After BACSA, you worked for 4Health.
Well, there was an interesting migration there, right? In 2001, I was recruited to 4Health Technologies. Joel Osborne and I have known each other since 1977, actually. And he came to me and said, look, I've got a project and you're the only guy I think can do it. You know, would you come? And I looked at it and said, yeah, this looks like a lot of fun. So we put together 4Health Technologies, wound up migrating from Oklahoma City down to Florida, which is where we now are. And in the process along there, we invented an IV robotic device and then this IV workflow product. And around 2009, BACSA bought 4Health. And so I came back to BACSA in the box. And 2 years later, Baxter bought BACSA and I came into Baxter in the box. And those transitions were actually very interesting. It was the first time I'd really looked at an acquisition process and what it's like to go through it. There's certainly a fair amount of disquiet that can occur on that. I have to say that in both cases, the process was thoughtful and was careful, and by and large was beneficial.
It could, though, have resulted in you losing your job and needing to look elsewhere.
Absolutely.
I mean, but that's a risk any job, quite frankly.
Especially, I mean, 4Health was a startup company, right? Yeah. So the notion that you start every day knowing exactly what to the penny what you've got in the bank and exactly what you're going to have to spend to get where you need to go and what it's going to take to get the next payroll is kind of a normal thing in a startup company. So you learn to live with a certain amount of ambiguity, which not everyone can do, and you learn to live with a certain amount of anxiety. It's part of what makes you want to come to work in the morning is that adrenaline of, you know, what it's going to take to get to the next place.
So before we leave this, why don't you describe your current responsibilities at Baxter?
My principal responsibilities involve the pharmacy drug delivery product therapy team, which I jokingly refer to as the artist formerly known as Baxa, and providing what medical affairs organizations ordinarily would provide. So research, literature, publication plans, those kinds of things. To support that particular business within the Baxter organization. I'm privileged to do a bunch of other things, including working with our government affairs organization with what we call a business model innovation group. And I do find myself being called on by the commercial part of the organization on a fairly regular basis as a content expert around pharmacy practice. And that has a number of wide and various things that allow me to do. So my biggest issue really is learning when to say no, and I'm not particularly good at it.
So to summarize, what would you tell young pharmacists who are considering moving from practice into industry? What do they need to keep in mind?
A few things. The first thing, as with any job, or any career move, I think the first thing we want to ask is, if I'm going to move to industry, why am I doing this? Right? Because there has to be a good reason that's consistent with your career path to say, okay, this is the next logical step for me to make. I think we need to understand, and no matter how prepared you may be for it, it's still a little tough, that the rules are different, that the talents that you bring to that new work environment are valued, but they are not valued in the same way that they were when you were working in practice. And that you're going to run into people who are very smart in things you never thought of. And if you're not willing to learn, right? If you're going to walk in there telling people how it is as opposed to being willing to learn, you're going to struggle. The other thing I think I would tell people, I certainly tell them this about informatics in general, even whether it's in industry or in practice, is that at the end of the day, the value we bring is our knowledge of our practice environment. And so this isn't a job I would ordinarily take. I wouldn't recommend going into industry without having a few miles on the tires, so to speak, so that you actually can speak with authority and have the professional network to get answers to questions that you don't immediately have the answers to, so that your value to the organization simply seems to grow the more people use you. But you have to walk in the door with that value.
Okay. You've been elected and served as ASHP's Section Chair for Pharmacy Informatics and Technology. Differentiate for us informatics and technology, since those two terms are used.
The distinction is probably not well defined, again, because the area is so new. But principally, we would look at informatics as looking at the distribution and use of data and its conversion into information, where technology generally implies that we are somehow using automated systems to manage mechanical devices. So you think of technology, you think of carousels, you think of infusion pumps, you think of robotic devices who do a variety of things. And that is a distinction that has turned out, I think, to be useful to the section in terms of being able to organize work and get certain things done.
They may, though, be used synonymously by lay people.
Oh, absolutely.
Like myself. What's the value of an ASHP section from your vantage point?
Sections, you know, I think turn out to be one of the really, really great things that ASHP's done in the last several years. More than anything else, those turn out to be places where people can work together on a national basis to accomplish some really good things. And again, this wouldn't be possible if we didn't have the informatics infrastructure we've already got. Excuse me. Just because our meetings are all virtual, and we have technologies that allow us to collaborate on documents and those kinds of things that 15, 20 years ago didn't exist. In terms of the section on informatics and technology, I specifically am proud of what it's been able to accomplish, because it's one of the few where pharmacists from practice, pharmacists from the consulting organizations, and pharmacists from the industry literally work side by side. And you know, if I were to point to some of the things that I look at and say, gee, I'm kind of proud that we did that, one of those clearly is the fact that during my presidency, we really, really expanded the role of industry pharmacists in that section. I might not be the first one, but I believe I'm one of the very few pharmacists who was actually working in industry at the time he was elected to a position. And I was frankly surprised. But you know, one of the really, really neat things that goes on every day in the section on informatics is that pharmacists in practice and pharmacists in industry and pharmacists who consult for a living all work together to do some pretty neat things.
So give us some examples of some of those neat things.
The one that immediately comes to mind, well, there are a few that immediately come to mind. There's an article that went into the Informatics Interchange. So an article series that we keep going in the journal called Whither Pharmacy Informatics, that was a joint effort by a group of three of us that I tend to refer to as some of the gray beards in the pharmacy informatics group. So that was Jerry Blair, John Poikin, and myself, that just talked about, okay, if you're thinking about informatics, what are you thinking about? What is the skill set that needed for this job? And it was a lot of fun to put together. And I really enjoyed working with these guys because they're some of the smartest people I know. So that was a pretty significant effort. But the one I'd really, really hold up that came out about the same year was a vision statement from the section, a vision statement on a technology-enabled practice, where we actually sat back and thought long and hard about, see, one of the things with tools is tools should change the way you work, right? My favorite analogy is a power saw. If I have a hand saw, then I saw. But if I took a power saw and ran it across a board like that, all I'd do is make a mess, right? But all I gotta do is pull that trigger. And a whole new world of sawing opens up to me. Mm-hmm. And our tools should be like that, right? And so it gave us a chance, and it was a lot of people involved in that. It was a really, really good collaborative effort. But we came away with what I thought was a really, really visionary statement on what pharmacy practice could look like if we had the right tools, and to talk about what those tools might actually be. It's a lot of fun. In the process, one of the things that surprised me was I'd gone to Lene Mahaney for some help with the VA experience. And one of the things I learned from what Lene was able to supply me with in terms of literature references is that the whole notion that we still need to defend the value of clinical pharmacy seems to me the defense is there. We simply need to pick it up and run with it. So we spent a lot of our time talking about how we would make clinical pharmacy work in that statement. But I'd encourage it to people's reading. I think it's still valid.
You had mentioned meaningful use. Educate folks who may not be knowledgeable about what meaningful use is and how it's valuable today.
Well, in the HITECH Act, one of the things that the federal government did was to recognize that we need to transition away from paper medical records into online medical records for a variety of reasons, including facilitating adjudication of claims, including reducing the cost of managing healthcare, and including improving the quality. So you take the IOM study to Air is Human and recognize that a significant chunk of what's recognized as medical error starts with the physician writing an order in a patient record. All of that could be improved if we were to have an electronic patient record with appropriate computerized decision support systems guiding interaction with that record. The problem you have is you can't just say to somebody, okay, you need to go buy this equipment, because as we learned with infusion pumps, for example, there were a lot of people who bought some very smart pumps and made them very dumb, right? So meaningful use was a method by which the federal government could, was a set of standards by which the federal government could determine whether or not you had not only acquired electronic medical records and the surrounding things, but were using them in a meaningful fashion. So this is a multi-phase series of evaluations. Meeting the criteria at any given phase gives you the opportunity to pick up a carrot, in this case, money. By the way, there's also a stick. Your failure after certain periods of time to meaningfully use these actually results in a loss of reimbursement from the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services. So meaningful use turned out to be important and has had a huge impact in a very short period of time on the deployment of electronic medical records, not only in hospitals, but in physicians' offices and clinics.
What are the unique needs of pharmacists that practice in informatics?
I'll go back to the Wither informatics article, because I think it really kind of drives that. You have to like it. You have to really like it. You have to be willing to understand not only the use of drugs clinically, because without that you can't make appropriate decisions, but you also have to understand the long-term downstream impacts of individual design decisions about something as simple as how you enter something into a formulary, or something as complex as how you put together a bunch of disparate systems to make them work together. You need to start looking at your profession. You need to be willing to look at your profession in a completely different way. You need to be willing to step back and ask yourself, why do I do that? And having asked that question, be willing to answer that question with, it doesn't really make any sense. We've just always done it that way. You have to be willing to ask yourself, what would the practice look like if I did it a different way? And you have to be an exceptional change manager, because most of the profession will struggle to follow you when you ask those questions, because we're very comfortable in the way we do things now. So you need change management capability, you need systems analysis capability, you actually need to know something about how software works and how database works. You don't need to be a programmer. There are other people who do that better. You don't need to be a database architect or a database administrator. There are other people who do that. But you need to know enough about those disciplines to know when they're serving your purpose and to know when they're not, so you can guide the direction and the implementation of the technology over which you have responsibility.
What advice do you have for young pharmacists that are interested in informatics?
Well, the first thing we said in the Wither informatics chapter, or article, and I still believe this very firmly. The first thing you need to do is you need to be a pharmacist. You need to do the job you're trained to do. You need to develop the experience necessary to actually be able to speak to the profession. That probably means working in more than one hospital. That probably means seriously looking at and getting involved with the acquisition of informatics products. It probably means trying your hand at programming, not so much because you're ever going to be a programmer, but because you need to understand the realities of how programs work. It definitely means having an ongoing love affair with technology and being attracted to working with it and trying to make it work in your environment. One of the big mistakes I see people making from time to time is becoming enamored of a technology, typically a hardware, not thinking about whether or not that hardware is actually suitable. So I have this smartphone. Certainly there must be something I can do with it. Well, maybe, maybe not. Is the screen big enough to read? Can it hold enough data? Is it properly secured? All of those things turn out to be interesting questions. If you're interested in informatics, you need to know the regulatory environment. You need to know about HIPAA. You need to know about high tech. You need to know about meaningful use. You need to know something about contracting and some other things that help you establish the kinds of business relationships with your vendor community that will be helpful. So spending some time doing those things is good experience. And I could probably go on ad nauseum, actually, but those are the things I would think of as being the most important.
And I think there are some informatics residencies available these days.
I'm aware of about four right now. I don't want to advertise any one of them, but it's the thing, that I like about these at the moment is they're PGY2 residencies. Okay, so you can't get into one of these until you've done a general residency and you actually have been at least exposed to the panoply of pharmacy practice, right? It's still not clear to me that someone coming out of one of those residencies has enough miles on the tires to actually make informatics a career. And I would still encourage them to spend some time in a role that is at least partly practice and partly informatics until they get that experience. Because I think at the end of the day, that's really what it takes to get into the role.
What's been the value of professional networking for you, and how do you maximize it now?
We often joke how small a world the pharmacy community actually is. I think first and foremost, you eventually have to get to the point, especially in informatics, where you recognize that you don't know everything. And maybe you can't know everything. And maybe there are some things that you could do, but other people would do better. And so having a ready connection with those individuals, so you can pick up the phone or drop out an email or what have you, and build a network and ask those questions and get those perspectives is really important. Some tools are fairly hands-off. I generally look at the communications that go through ASHP Connect, for example, as kind of hands-off. I'll throw a question over the wall and someone will throw an answer back over the wall. But what I even find there is that eventually if your answers are thoughtful and your questions are thoughtful, eventually you develop connections with individuals who really want to explore a process in detail, and those become connections. Attending meetings and actually getting physical meetings going with individuals. I find that personally, until I put a name and a face and a voice together, I don't have a connection with that individual. When I have that connection, I can pick up the phone and have a trusting conversation on any of a variety of issues, and it works reasonably well. And it's worth the time and the effort to keep those relationships intact, even when I'm not doing anything at the moment that needs them. I use a an email service that reminds me when people have birthdays, and I make sure that I get, you know, they're online e-cards, and nobody's fooled about how much effort I went to do that. But at least once a year, we exchange something. How are you doing? What's going on in your life? I'm looking for. And it's just amazing how often those just suddenly crop up, being useful either to the other person, to yourself.
Let us benefit from your unique perspective. Please talk with us about the value of the currently available social media and what pharmacists should be aware of as they use that, either career-wise or personally.
Social media is a two-edged sword, very definitely. And I think that one of the things we're learning with social media is that different generations communicate with each other in highly different ways. Being somewhat older, I have a tendency to use email, my daughter's Twitter, right, and tweet. And I think that the thing we have to kind of look at here, and I guess the first thing, I always approach these with a bit of caution. In fact, I even approach email with a bit of caution, simply because it represents a venue from which nothing ever disappears, right? So how I use this, whether personally, whether publicly or in private, how I use these venues paints a picture of me that never gets erased.
Even if you attempt to erase or delete, it's still there.
Absolutely, and it's for many people, it's become their picture of Dorian Gray. It's really, really difficult. You know, photographs that you thought were completely innocent at some point come back to haunt you in a job application. And employers do scour the social media to evaluate new employees. So we're never really off the job, especially when we're using social media. And we need to be careful of the picture that we paint of ourselves in that regard. There's been a lot of real interest in healthcare, especially if we were to actually move to a completely capitated method of paying for healthcare, about how we might use social media to improve the relationships and the correspondence between care providers and patients. And again, I think we have the same issues there. Patients still need to worry about their privacy and how much privacy they can have in a social media environment. There have to be ways of managing those conversations. There are regulatory and litigatory issues that you worry about in terms of doing that. But I've talked to physicians who've told me, frankly, they wouldn't need to see me quite as often, and they would probably be able to help me manage my care far more effectively if we were emailing each other. One of the things we've seen in the medical device community that's starting to get interesting is just the notion of having devices tweet over a secure channel back to a database that allows us to better manage and monitor their behavior. Fairly far away from that at this point, but it's an interesting use of the concept. But I generally see social media as being more applicable to personal than to professional activity. And so I'm going to be interested to see how it evolves. At the moment, I'm a bit skeptical of it.
This kind of leads into my next question about what changes do you think will happen in informatics and technology over the next 5 to 10 years that are going to affect pharmacy practice?
The things that I really hope will happen at this point, because I'm still seeing us struggling with some of these issues, is that we will get past the growth curve of getting people on online medical records, and we will begin to actually leverage the promise that those databases of patient data provide. And that suggests that there's a need for a group of tools out there that are probably now only in their infancy, that help us digest this massive amount of information and bring to our attention those things that require our attention and input. good friend of mine, in fact, the fellow who started Health Data Sciences, Ralph Kortman, used to talk about the complementary features of a computer system and a human. Because a computer system can doggedly apply and rigidly apply a set of rules over a massive amount of data and never get tired and never make a perceptual error, right? Barcode scanners never misread a barcode, almost never. Right? Human beings have known error rates. In fact, there's a surprisingly robust amount of information coming out of the nuclear power regulatory industry and oil rigs, of all places, that talk about the propensity of an intelligent human being to make a mistake. And at the end of the day, an error rate of roughly 3%, so 3 out of 100 transactions, is considered normal for an intelligent human being. And when you put that individual under pressure, that rate can raise as high as 25%. So when we look at the notion that we as human beings have perceptual failures, we get tired, we develop confirmation bias, we do all sorts of those things. Expecting ourselves to do this kind of work is really, really foolish. And in point of fact, we are probably now at the point in our professional practice where the sheer volume and acuity of work we're doing is so high that it is beyond the capacity of human diligence. So what we really need to be doing is focusing that perceptual energy on the cases that need our attention. Alan Flynn did an op-ed piece on what he called NUPOR, Nearly Universal Pharmacist Order Entry, and he raised the question that by looking at every order, were we somehow missing the opportunity to really spend our energy on the orders that need our process? And so the role of the computer should be to digest all that mostly normal information and find the needles in that informatics haystack that really deserve our attention. And then the role of the human is to do the things humans do that computers can't do, which is the ability to make intuitive leaps based on incomplete information, to develop a set of direction where, you know, an intense analysis of all the available data would probably leave you confused, right? Dr. Kortman used to refer to the notion that as a hematologist, he'd walk into a hospital room and he'd look at the patient and he'd go, liver cancer, and then spend the next 3 days proving that he was right or wrong. But there's this gestalt process that we've never been able to computerize and are likely unlikely to be able to do so. So the best match of the tool to the person is to create a process where the tool finds all the things I should be looking at, presents them to me, and then lets me apply my unique skills to focusing on those. And that, I think, is the next real horizon. The current computerized decision support systems The current computerized decision support systems focus mostly on order entry. But a significant chunk of what needs to be focused on are the downstream impacts of what appears to be a benign order. And so we're talking now about products, and there are a few now on the market that actually are starting to do this, that actually watch patients over time who might be at risk, right, and come back and say, you might want to go follow up on that guy because he's been on Coumadin for 4 days and there's no INR in the chart, right? And those kinds of things. There's starting to be now some what are called inference engines at which you can literally throw a database with no guidance at all, and the inference engine will actually go through and come up and tell you about all of the data relationships that it finds. And some of them are, yeah, okay, fine, that's right. You never have oophorectomies in a male patient, right? But then there are others that turn out to be, oh my God, I never saw that value. I never saw that association. And I think that's the next big thing, just this notion of something that's constantly watching this on a population basis and is noticing relationships that we should at least investigate. They may not turn out to be real. They may turn out to have an undisclosed cause, but we need to look at them. And right now, we don't even know that we need to look at them. And we don't have the mental capacity to find them without computerized assistance.
What advice do you have for non-informatics pharmacists of keeping up or trying to stay abreast of what might be coming?
I think the reality is first and foremost that pharmacists need to be aware that informatics should change the way they work. Okay. One of the biggest mistakes I see pharmacists doing generally is taking technology and layering it on top of what is a currently evolved practice. And if it's looked at closely in many cases, it's broken in various places, or it relies on tribal knowledge or on inference, things that make it very hard to replicate and scale. And so first and foremost, if you're thinking about applying technology, you really want pharmacists to think about what would my practice look like if I used this technology the way it was designed to be used? And then how do I go about teaching myself to do that without driving myself crazy? I think pharmacists need to recognize that the technology that they use in their personal lives is fundamentally different than the technology that they use in their professional work. Now, from time to time, it may be possible for the same device to do both. But in point of fact, by and large, there are rules around the stuff you use for work that you don't have to live with, right? You can't just completely make it your own because somebody else has to pick it up behind you and keep working. So you have to approach that technology differently, certainly with a certain amount of care that you might not in dealing with your personal technology.
As you think back over your career, how do you judge your own success? Success measures. I know that's a tough question, but.
Actually, I had given some thought to that because you asked me. And I think at the end of the day, I look back over time and I think, okay, there were moments when I felt success. The marriage of my children, the birth of my grandchildren, seeing people who were my students when I was early in my career who now occupy positions of authority both in practice and in industry. People who periodically call me up and say, gee, I remember when you said, right? Now the opportunity to mentor new students and see them asking hard questions and pushing the boundaries of the profession. And to the extent that I've had anything to do with that, I find that a measure of success. Knowing that a product I was involved in making actually improved the safety of patients, and I actually have data to support that, that's a pretty big measure of success. But by and large, success is a set of vignettes. You'll notice I didn't talk much about money. I took the job in industry, my first job in industry, with a $20,000 a year cut in pay because I knew I would love it that much. Turned out I loved it too much, but there's something to be said for wanting to get out of bed every morning and do what you do. And I think that in itself is a measure of success.
Dennis, these have been great comments. I really appreciate your time. Thank you very much.
It's been my pleasure. I enjoyed it, Sarah.